If you spank your children, you're an abusive parent.
You can't believe in freedom and take away my right to own a gun.
Homeschool children have no social skills.
I won't go anywhere near a PC. I'll only use Mac.
No one has the right to tell me what to do with my body.
LeBron will never be better than Jordan.
All Southerners.
Chocolate's definitely better because vanilla is green.
So when you get really busy, what's the first thing that drops out of your schedule in the midst of chaos? Is it healthy eating? There's a vintage staff member who this is their issue. For confidentiality, I'll just call him Jay Clark. He's our videographer. I saw him one time have a hot pocket in one hand and a Twinkie in the other hand. And he could tell I was really concerned about him. And so later he came back and he said, "Well, I ate a peach to balance it out." To which I said, "Jay, I'd like to talk about logic, but I think it's more than logic. It might be stress. You were crying as you ate a Twinkie. Something is happening not right here. Is it healthy eating or is it exercise?" Like, nobody really likes to exercise. You just do it so you don't die too early. And so does that fall out and you justify binge watching Netflix in bed because you're tired and stressed? Or for me, it's communication. I love to make my family laugh and be sassy with them, but when I get stressed out, I start giving them very short, three-word, one-liners, and then it goes to, I just grunt at them, and then when I'm really stressed, I just walk in the room and stare at them. If you walk into a room with human beings and you just stare at them, you're way too stressed out. So what is it? And here's the interesting thing. We as a culture equate busyness with success. We equate busyness with importance, busyness with getting things done. Though every study, and I mean every study, would say the opposite. That health issues, obesity, heart problems are skyrocketing because of busyness and stress. I read one article that the average commuter in traffic has more stress than a fighter pilot. Now, I don't know how you would validate that. I read it, though. It has to be true, right? Or there's the thing called secondhand stress, that your friends and your spouse and your kids are stressed out because you are so stressed that you're constantly pouring it into their lives. So you feel this stress, and you know that things that are important in your life are starting to fall off your schedule, and you make some pledges to yourself that you're going to re-up, right? You're going to eat healthy again. So you go to Whole Foods, and you buy an apple, a corn stalk, and milk. It's $224. You go home, you're going to eat healthy, but you get stressed out, the food spoils, and you're back at McDonald's. Or you're going to sleep more. And yet you're so busy, you find yourself laying in bed at 2 a.m. demanding of yourself that you fall asleep right this instant, which doesn't work. So it's just this cycle that perpetuates. There's always more and there's always things to overwhelm you. And then you come to church and the message of the sermon is absolute prayer. And that seems like the last straw. I mean, the passage starts this way in Ephesians chapter 3, verse 14. It says, "For this reason, I bow my knees." It's just all about prayer. And then, as if that's not guilt-producing enough, the jerk up front reads quotes like this. One Christian said, "Every Christian needs a half hour of prayer each day, except when he is busy, then he needs an hour." How do you feel? Or Martin Luther, who kind of was more busy than you. He was changing Western society. He said this, "I have so much to do that I shall spend the first 3 hours in prayer." Now I feel horrible. And if that doesn't stick you like it stuck me, this one will get you if nothing else. I mean, this is just guilt producing and straight in your face. A guy named Charles Haddon Spurgeon says, a prayerless church member is a hindrance. He is in the body like a rotting bone or a decayed tooth. Before long, since he does nothing to contribute to the benefit of his brethren, he will become a danger and a sorrow to them. Do you know how frustrating that is? I mean, I want to pray, and I try to pray as much as I can, but most often I feel guilty that I'm not praying. I've tried things to help me. I've tried little note cards. I've tried journals. I write like a kindergartner. I can't even read what I wrote when I go to pray the next time. That didn't work. I try to pray in the morning and at night, sometimes when I'm walking. I've tried praying in a closet because evidently that's a thing, and that didn't work either. So it's this constant thing spilling up against me. And yet I've come to realize this. There's a time where you have to look at the things that are burning your life down and not let them burn your life down anymore. There's going to be a time where you have to choose critical things over really important things. And I'm not blind to how hard that's going to be for you. That's going to be you looking at the possibility of making more money and saying no. Because you realize that with that is going to come a lot more responsibility and you're already burning out. You're going to have to say no at times to career advancement because it's a 70-hour, 80-hour work week for you and you just can't be alive and do that. You're going to have to be less known than you currently are, and that's hard for us. But the trade is really important. The trade-off, if you'll take critical things over just important things, is you're going to be healthier. You'll live past 35, and that's a good thing for you to do. You will have deep friendships. You'll have a vibrant relationship with Jesus. No one has ever said at the end of their life, I wish I was more busy and more stressed out. What's it going to be? You're going to have to pick between craze and life. Life is not found in craze. It's either or. Make the right call. Choose more of Jesus and more friends and more of health for you and for us. There's some things that bring the fullness of life to you. And prayer is at the very top of the list of that. Yet our whole life is set up against being prayerful people. You have constant stimuli. You have adult ADHD like me. You wake up early in the morning and you take off and you don't stop running until 18 hours later when you go to bed. And yet I want this place to be free of guilt. I don't want you to come and hear a conversation about prayer and then all of a sudden feel guilty that you're not praying. The most that guilt can do in your prayer life is help you pray for just 1 week. You'll have enough shame and enough angst that you're not praying that you'll do it for a week and then things will get chaotic again and you'll not pray anymore. So what if we could go a different route? What if somehow we could fill prayer up like it's supposed to be filled up, the way that God intended it to be filled up, that we looked towards prayer with eagerness, like some very nostalgic thing that we couldn't wait to engage in again, like waking up in the morning and having your first mug of coffee or waiting for the fall to finally arrive and the leaves to fall in a fire in the fireplace or going to the movies and smelling popcorn. You can't wait to put your face in that tub. That eagerness. Could we possibly retool prayer to be that in your life? Now, as I read books and listened to podcasts and thought about prayer this week, I realized that most of the conversation about prayer is instruction. You're not praying, I'm not praying. And so let's try to instruct each other in how we can pray. And so we do note cards or journals, or we take a word like Acts and we break it down, and A is for adoration, and C is for confession, and this is how you pray, and then T is for thanksgiving, S is for supplication, but I don't know what supplication means, so I Google supplication, and 42 seconds later, I'm on Facebook, and I'm not praying at all, right? That's kind of the pattern, and so some instruction for prayer can be helpful if you're praying. But if you're not praying, then maybe instruction is just guilt-producing and will do the opposite of what you want it to do. And so what I want us to think about this morning is just two questions. Why pray? Why should you pray? There is a whole new movement in motivational thinking around that one little word, why. Full organizations are starting to help companies think about their why question and answer why. And I listened to a TED Talk a couple of weeks ago about why. And the woman presenting was absolutely brilliant. She was winsome and funny. She set a new reality for me. I was kind of standing on a new hill that I had just taken, and I had a different view. I could answer why you should give resources and why you should bleed and why you should do these things. And I really got pumped up. Why is the question for everything? But then I realized this. There's always something that precedes the why, and it's the who. if you can't answer your why questions with a who, then your questions are foolish and pointless. That which is lasting and that which is deep and meaningful is always who, the who of community, the who of justice, the who of freedom, the who of love, the who of life. And so we need to make sure that we're starting with the who question. There's two who's in this passage, the you who and the greater who of Jesus. Let's start with the greater one. Look back at verse 14. It says, "For this reason, I bow before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth is named." When we pray, we're not praying to clear our minds, to find inner peace. We're not trying to awaken one of 330 million Hindu gods, hoping that a distant deity might take pity on us. We're not delving down into positivism, trying to surround ourselves with nice, pretty colors and good thoughts. We're praying to a God who knows us and names us. And for many of you, it's a renaming. God is a good daddy, and a good daddy, a good mother, always names a child a good name. We don't name our children Northwest. We don't name our children Apple or like Brad and Jaylena's eighth child, Chocolatini. We're not going to name our kids things like that. We want good names. And so when I was able with my wife to name our first daughter, we named her Eliana. We were told that she had a hole in her heart and would probably die at birth. And so we named her, "My God has answered us," believing that God can heal and asking him to heal. But even if he didn't, he had still answered us. We named our second daughter Lila Suzanne after her mama. Her mama is ferocious and brilliant, a great leader, and most of all, she loves Jesus. And we wanted that little girl to be ferocious, brilliant, but above all other things, to love Jesus. We named our little boy Lincoln after Abraham Lincoln, who did the right thing in an impossible situation, fighting for justice, standing up for men and women. We want to raise a little boy who does the right thing in the midst of injustice and loves men and women. And so I'm a broken earthly father. If I can name my kids names of meaning and value, how much more will God name you? Even if your current name isn't a name full of meaning, he has this thing in the scriptures where he renames people. He took this guy named Simon, who was fickle and thin and cowardly, and he named Simon the Rock, Peter. And he said, "On you, I will build the most powerful thing that the world has ever seen." He took a egomaniac named Saul, and he named Saul Humble, the humble one, Paul. And Paul went out into the world and spent his life not ever drawing attention to himself, but pointed to something even greater. When you pray, you're speaking to a God who knows you, who has named you. He's present and he's personal. You should pray to this God. But not just is he personal and present. Look at what he says in chapter 3, verse 20. He says, "He is able to do far more abundantly than all we ask or think, according to the power at work within us." I think this is the fundamental issue for us. I think in this verse lies the primary reason of why we don't pray. We don't pray because we don't think that God is really able. If we really thought that God was able to intercede and to act and to change and to heal, we would regularly, with eagerness, be asking the Father to enter into our lives and to bring change. We would do it as hopeful and as passionate as we possibly could, but we just don't think he's able. So I got really stuck on this one. I got stuck in how do I convince my family and myself that God is able? I could go to the Old Testament and the New Testament and show you women and men who didn't want to pray but did and then learned that God was able. I could tell you stories about men and women who are sitting beside you, part of your family, who have prayed and God has changed the most devastating scenarios into life, into fullness. I could just challenge you. Hey, why don't you try it? Just try prayer and see if God is able. And don't think that God has to answer you exactly the way that you've prayed. Maybe he's going to answer you in a way that you didn't expect. And that thing is the very thing that builds life into you, right? It's not that Garth Brooks prayer, "Thank God for unanswered prayers." It's not that. Maybe he gives you the opposite, and that's the good thing. Paul in 2 Corinthians says this, I've had some mountaintop experiences in my life that you couldn't even imagine. I've been miraculously used to heal people by God, but it wasn't the mountaintop that changed me. It was the thorn in my flesh. I prayed 3 times, Paul says. I prayed and prayed and prayed that God would remove this, and he didn't. And it was the thorn that he didn't remove that showed me that he was able to bring grace and mercy into my life. So I was stuck in this one for a while. And then I finally realized how to get unstuck, how to show us that God is able. This verse takes place in the larger context of Ephesians chapter 3. And Ephesians chapter 3 is about the second great miracle of God in Ephesians chapter 2, that he's taken individuals that he's rescued, you and me, and he's put us together doing the impossible, reconciling the irreconcilable, and he's made us into living stones. And so as you become the church and as I become the church, we become the apologetic of God for those who are in the midst of darkness and those in the midst of doubt. You're the apologetic of God. What that means is I desperately need you to show me that God is able. Because in my life, doubt is 10 times more likely than great faith. And I'm in a place where regularly I need you to be living stones, to be the body of Jesus, to show me that Jesus is able so that I can get out of darkness and out of doubt and see Jesus again. And you need the same thing. You need each other and you need me. You need us telling stories about when God is able. I need to tell you that I didn't want to be a follower of Jesus. I wasn't religiously inclined, but God just jumped up into my life and he radically changed me. And that can happen for you. You need to know that I didn't want to plant a church. It wasn't my life dream, but God used me and some friends to plant a church and help love a city. And God is able to do immeasurably more than you can ask or imagine. He wants to do this in your life, right? Sometimes we take what happens here too casually. You think that we've just gathered to sing some songs and talk about scripture, but what really is happening in this place is we're developing into the actual flesh and blood of the fact that God is definitively able to do all things in your life. And so when you are casual about your participation in the body, because you're the living stones, when you're casual about prayer, when you come when you want to and you don't when you don't want to, you travel all the time, you're not demonstrating that God is able to each other. You should join us regularly. You should join us in prayer on Wednesday mornings at 7. Involve yourself in these things because we're showing that God is able. He is able. You should ask him. But the beautiful part of this verse is he's not just able. He's not just like barely strong enough to accomplish what's in your life. How does he say it instead? It says that he is immeasurably more able to do everything that you ask or even think. And I love that. There's some things in your life that need to happen that you can't even think about right now. You don't even know they need to happen. And God is already working those things in your life. He's that able to do things in and for you. Think about that with me for a moment. What's the hardest thing for you to do? What paralyzes you the most? God is already working in those things. One thing that's really hard for us is to change our current condition, where you are right now. Life is hard for you. You have lots of responsibilities. People are pulling you in many different directions. Finances are hard. It's hard to make budget work. You are hurt and broken like everybody else. And so for you to begin to reorient the trajectory of your life, it's really hard to do that. You're going to have to pick up big pieces of your life, remove it, so you can put new things in your life and begin to alter the course of your life. That's hard to do, right? But there's something even harder than changing now. It's going to be harder for you to change 6 months from now or 6 years from now to alter your future. To alter your future, not only do you have to change now, but you have to have a God who intercedes to keep you from the storms of life, because you can be on the right trajectory and then just be hijacked by somebody else's life, abused, taken advantage of, left, hated, mocked, fired. And then all of a sudden, the course that you had started is gone. So the future, it's really hard. And God's saying he's able to change now, and he's able to change the future. But now in the future, they're not the hardest things to change. The hardest thing to change is your past. And your past is the hardest thing to change because you have no capacity to go back and change things. You can apologize, but you can't go back and change. You can forgive or seek forgiveness, but you can't go back and change. You can reconcile, but there's no way you can go back and undo what you did. And the God who looks at you and has named you says, I'm not only able to do what you need, I'm able to go back and change everything. It says in Joel chapter 2, verse 25, I will restore the years the locust has eaten. God is so great and so powerful that he's able to go back and restore that which is totally broken. So the fruitless years of your life, right? You have one and only one life. And every one of us have periods that we've just wasted. We've wasted a year. We've wasted a decade. We find ourselves 50, 60, 70, and we've just meandered. And God is saying, when you finally wake up and realize that you're not supposed to waste this one and only life. When shame hits in that moment, God says, I can go back to the fruitless years and change that and give you a harvest where there's no harvest. That's how powerful he is. The painful years. Pain is paralyzing. Things have been done to you that you think you'll never be healed from, never overcome. They've altered even your personality and your trust of God. And God's saying, I know what those painful years were like, and I can go back and I can heal you even though pain has crippled you in the here and now. Watch me. I can do more than you can ask or even think up your loveless years. I can change those loveless years. I know that you have always wanted to be in love and to be adored. And you are getting ever older and you're single and you don't feel like you'll ever be fully loved. Or you got married and you thought it would be different, that you'd be adored, and you're more lonely in marriage than you've ever been any other time of your life, that God can go back into those moments and he looks at what the locust has eaten and he can restore what it has eaten and he can love you in the midst of the hardest times. This God is able. The rebellious years are his, and the destructive years are his, and the years that you are without Jesus, they are his years too. Pray to this God. Watch him do that which is unthinkable even, right? So that's the greater who, Jesus. Let's talk about you now and me. Who is it that goes to God with these needs? Are you a beggar? Are you a coward? Are you a slave? Because that's not what the scriptures say about you. Knowing who you are in relationship to the person that you're communicating with changes everything about your communication, doesn't it? If you're going to your boss as an employee and you're communicating, you better be professional and timely. You better have ideas and be winsome. That's how communication goes between an employee and a boss. If you're in love, you communicate much different, don't you? When you see the person that you love, like joy oozes out of your eyes. Everybody's kind of like, enough, right? When you see them, you have pet names for them and nobody else knows what you're talking about. If you're clever and godly, you have those kind of names. You have little handshakes that you're doing right now. You're squeezing their hand and there's communication there. That's the communicational love. You don't do that with your boss. That would be weird. But you do it with your lover. Do you know who you are in regards to God? That's why we spent so long in Ephesians. We spent week after week after week teaching you, telling us about our identity, who we are in the presence of God. We said that you're saints. It's a demarcation of status. It means that you're royal, that you have the ear of the king. You're literally at the seat of power and the seat of authority, the seat of rule, and God, who does not need your counsel, listens to you, interacts with you, speaks to you. That's the God that you're praying to as a cabinet member of the high God of the universe. You're just right there and you have the attention of the king. You should talk to that king. He's right there. It says in the scriptures that you are absolutely adopted in Ephesians chapter 1, that you are sons and daughters. And so it's really good to have the ear of the king, but it's endlessly better to be a daughter or a son of the king. It's been said throughout Christianity that no one can wake the king up at 2 a.m. except for his daughter or his son. You're the daughter of the high king. You're his son. You should wake him up at 2 a.m. and tell him your fears. He'll listen. You should wake him up at 6 a.m. and though he's tired, cuddle him, sit in his lap. Just like a little 7-year-old boy climbs up in his daddy's lap and just wants to sit there. Just go sit with God. Tell him your wildest imaginative dreams and watch God jump up and walk with you. Jesus is there with you. He laughs with you. He weeps with you. That's what it says in John, that he weeps with us. Go as his sons and daughters. Pray to this God. Speak to this God. You're the masterpiece of God, we said. You were ruined and you were broken. You had taken this lovely thing and you had graffitied it and taken a knife to the canvas and just ripped it apart. And that God came and he should have been done with us. He should have just thrown our ruined masterpiece out. But God came and he didn't just restore the masterpiece. He didn't kind of glue it back together and add some new paint. He totally glorified you as his masterpiece. He's interested in your life. He's glorifying you. You're ministers, it says in the Gospels. It says that in Ephesians chapter 2 and 3. You are an ambassador of the high God. You're supposed to be doctors in a war-torn zone where you go and find people who are wounded and bleeding out and you heal them. You're diplomats who bring the peace of the king everywhere you go. And this, you being a minister, was so important to God that he gave his son for us so that we could take his son and now go give his son to other people. This is who we are. And we get to go as sons, as heirs, as saints, as ministers, as masterpieces, and communicate to the King of Kings. That's who he is. That's who you are. And so let's finish our time with that last question. We know the who. What about the why? Why should you pray? The structure of the passage is this. For this reason, I bow my knees, and everything that comes after is because of prayer. And so verse 16 and 17 says this. This is one of the results of prayer, that according to the riches of his glory, he may grant you to be strengthened with his power through his spirit in your inner being, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith. When you pray, you are strengthened. It's a direct result of prayer. There's some things in your life that you are only strong in if you regularly engage in those things. For example, I grew up at the beach. I'll talk about the beach for the rest of my life. I like to surf. And the only way to be in shape for surfing is if you surf regularly. You can't be in shape for it any other way, even if you're in great shape. So a couple of weeks ago, I was taking some guys who had never been surfing before out to learn to surf. And when you're first learning, you get these giant boards. They're like canoes. And if the waves are little, it's really fun. If the waves are big, it's like tying a canoe to your ankle and just getting pummeled. Right? So the wave hits the canoe and it just drags you around. So we're driving to Nag's Head and the forecast is for waves to be 4 to 6 feet. They measure the back of the wave, and so the front of the wave is probably 6 to 7 feet. And so I'm talking about, I mean, you guys are going to get beat to death today, and you'll probably live, so it'll be fun. As we drive out there, the forecast changes, and it goes to 5 to 7 feet. And then when we get there, it's 6 to 8 feet. So we jump in the water, and we're paddling out, and 45 minutes later, these two guys make it out. They're breathing, and they're sweating, and they're bleeding, and they finally make it out. As the day goes, the waves get bigger and bigger. They get up to 10 to 12 feet. It sounds like a military jet is flying over when these waves start to break. So I'm paddling back out after a wave. They're sitting out past the breakers. And I see this set coming in that's the biggest set by far of the day. And I'm trying to point to them, but I'm out of breath. And they're just kind of looking at me waving, right? And so this 10-foot wave comes in. And I have this tiny little surfboard that's a potato chip. And I just dive right under the wave. And I look back and they're gone. Just gone from the wave. A second wave comes, a third wave comes, and I look back, and I'm pretty sure I've killed these guys. They're dead. And I think, meh. They're followers of Jesus. They're in heaven already. It's going to be okay, right? It's okay. 5 minutes later, they're both on the shore, just laid out, breathing hard, literally sprawled out on the shore. What allowed me to get out and them not? Only that I had been surfing my whole life, and I had surfed all summer, and I was in shape. Prayer is the exercise of your soul. If you don't exercise your soul, you're just worn out. If you do, you have strength that others don't. Do you understand that? Maybe some of the darkness that you're going through, maybe some of the difficulties, maybe some of the doubt is because your soul's worn out. You've been entrusted this thing that's meant to make you strong in the presence of God, and you just don't participate in it. We need to be a formidable lot. We need to be strong men and women who can go into a war-torn world and be ambassadors and doctors and diplomats and take peace everywhere we go, right? But we never pray, and so we're thin and we're weak and we're worn down. Prayer is this invitation to sit in the presence of God. And where God is, there's healing. And where God is, there's power. And where God is, there's strength. He'll change your present and your future and your past. Speak to him. Pray to him. Be with him. He'll make you strong. And then finally, here's the last thing that prayer does in this passage. It's a beautiful verse. You know it well. It takes place in 17b through 19. It says this, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may have strength to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth of God's love, and to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge. Listen, love thrives best face-to-face. It's why long-distance relationships are so challenging. They can make it, but they're really, really difficult. When I talk to friends about love, when I talk to spouses about love, I tell them the same thing every time. You need more time together, not less. If you're in a really difficult time, if you're really fighting and you're angry, to spend lots of time apart just pushes pause on the issues and it lets them fester and become more bitter. What you need is to come together face to face, spend more time together, and let love redevelop. You never grow apart as friends. You never just grow apart as husband and wife. You choose to grow apart. Right? Love thrives face to face. You fell in love because you spent time together, because you had respect and tenderness and sacrifice for each other. And love grows and becomes more and more when you spend time with each other and you sacrifice and you're tender and you respect each other. So prayer is the thing that brings you face to face with God so that you can grow in your love for God and so that you can begin to comprehend God's love for you, right? God's love is so astonishing and so massive and so counterintuitive. You can't just read about the love of God. You can't just hear about it. You can't comprehend the love of God by experiencing somebody else's experience. You have to sit in it and be changed by that love. Paul looks right at you and says, you need to comprehend how broad the love of God is. It's broad enough for every human being who has ever lived to be changed. You need to understand how deep the love of God is. God's love is deep enough to overcome every sin, no matter if it's racism or rape or hatred or brokenness. It's deep enough. It is high enough to lift you up into heaven and keep you with Jesus. And it's long enough to keep you there forever and ever and ever. And so when you sit down and you pray, you come face to face with this love, but it's no longer for the world, it's for you. And you start to understand for you how broad the love of God is. It's broad enough for your life. You start to see how deep God's love is. It's deep enough for your sin. It's long enough to keep you with God forever, and it will take you into the presence of Jesus as he lifts you up. This is prayer. It's a critical thing in your busy life that brings you face to face with God, and he uses it to strengthen you and to help you understand who he is. Would you pray to this daddy who loves you? Let's pray. God, we ask that this simple passage would become true in our lives. For our friends that are doubters and seekers, they would sense the love of God in this place, how broad and high and deep and long it is, and they would be changed by love. And God, for us as followers of Christ, we wouldn't feel guilty about not praying, but we would totally reorient our understanding about what prayer is, that it's sitting in the lap of the Father and being loved by him. And that changes everything about our life, Lord. Let us be men and women who pray, Lord. We love you, Jesus, and we ask these things in your great name. Amen.